Hi, I'm Eric Bischoff, and you're listening to the Gurek Report podcast with your hosts, Steve Gurek and Frank V.
January the 19th, 2015. I am Steve Gerwick of Gerwick.net. That's G-E-R-W-E-C-K.net. I want to say happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day to everybody out there listening today. And let's say what's up to my co-host, Frank D.
What's up, everybody? I want to send a special shout-out to the Cults of Kayfabe Facebook page for allowing me to do some things over there, so that's really cool. And today, GRP listeners, we have a doozy for you. The man that I'm about to introduce right now is a former AWA announcer. He is a former president of World Championship Wrestling, creator of Monday Nitro, the only man to ever take it to the WWE and nearly put him out of business. He is also the co-founder of Bischoff Herbie Entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, in my opinion, a guy who should be in the WWE Hall of Fame, Mr. Eazy-E, Eric Bischoff.
Well, hell, that was one of the best build-ups I've ever had. I think I'm going to hang up now and just let this thing end on a really good note.
How are you doing today, sir?
Doing really well. I'm just wrapping up some business today here in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona, and heading to Los Angeles tomorrow for a couple of meetings and then making my way towards Philadelphia for the big debate. And then to a television conference in Washington, D.C. So it's going to be a busy 10 days for me, but I'm really looking forward to Philadelphia.
Now, before we dive into a lot of the wrestling questions, can you tell us what's going on currently with Bischoff Herbie Entertainment?
Ah, well, there's a lot. BHETV, or Bischoff Herbie Entertainment, we are currently in post-production on a show that we're doing for WGN called Outlaw Country, and it's going to premiere on February 24th. My partner Jason Hervey is immersed in that project as we speak, and extremely excited about it. I've been watching the dailies as they come, you know, across my desk, and looking at network notes and so forth. And the show is intense. It's really, really intense. If you're interested at all in the reality of behind the scenes of law enforcement and behind the scenes of those that are on the opposite side of law enforcement, this is a really unique perspective. It'll give you an entirely different view of their respective worlds, and it's done really well. Great cast, great crew, and it's a fantastic concept. And we had great access, so just want to thank everybody involved. But I'm really excited about that. In addition to that show, we've got probably five others in various stages of development. Kind of premature to talk about them at this point. But there were some pretty big networks in their starting projects. We have BHE, and Jason and I own a company called MX Digital that produces and distributes online slot machines based on celebrities and brands. So we've got a Hulk Hogan slot machine, and this stuff is available on Facebook. You can go and play it for free. It's not so waged games like you have in Las Vegas. You can play the social version of these games. But we have at the MX Casino on Facebook, we've got a Hulk Hogan game. We've got Dennis Rodman. We've got Chuck Norris. We've got James Dean. Got a brand new series, a brand new game based on a comic book or graphic novel called El Paso that we're really jacked about. It's very, very cool. You know, if you could imagine Quentin Tarantino, you know, designing a slot machine, that's kind of what it would look like. It's very cool. Oh, we've got Buffalo Bill Cody Beer. That's something else that Jason and I own together under BHE. Buffalo Bill Cody Beers, yeah, we've been doing it now since 2011. Been distributing the product in Wyoming, Montana, North, South Dakota. just recently expanded into Arizona, Nevada, starting this week, and soon to be Colorado and Florida. So it's been a long, slow learning process, but the beer business is really starting to take hold for us as well. So kind of excited about that.
That sounds real good.
That's about it for now, guys.
Great.
But it's early on Monday, so that could change by the end of the day.
As far as your beer goes, I just have a question for you about that. Is your beer going to be ever coming to Houston, Texas?
You know, Tessie, the answer is hopefully yes, probably, but it's going to be a while down the road. Texas, every state is, and I don't want to bore your listeners with, you know, a dissertation of the beer business, but the beer business, wine business, the liquor business in general is a very complex, unusual architecture of local and state and federal laws. So navigating, you don't want to circumvent laws when it comes to alcohol. You learned that one a long time ago. But when you're trying to navigate the various local, city, county, state, federal ordinances and controls, some states are a lot easier and some are much more complex. Texas happens to be one of the more expensive / complex states to introduce a product into. So it'll probably happen, but not for a while.
The first question I had for you right off the bat is WWE Hall of Fame. Eventually, I think you're going to get in. Have you ever been approached about going in the WWE Hall of Fame? And when do you think would be a right time for somebody of yourself to eventually accept the offer of going into the WWE Hall of Fame?
Well, you asked two questions there. No, nobody's ever approached me. And as far as when someone like me should be considered or consider it, I don't know. It's an individual thing. You know, I don't really think about it too much. You know, obviously I've been asked the question many times before and I never really have a very good answer because I have mixed emotions about it. You know, there's a part of me, when I say egos, most people refer to an ego or characterize an ego as a negative kind of selfish thing. And I look at ego as just a sense of yourself and who you are and what you've done. My ego, it's normal, it's natural, it's healthy, and that part of me I would enjoy being asked. It would validate in what I've done, I guess, in some ways. But at the same time, I don't think I'm really totally comfortable with it either. And when I say that, it's because to me, this is just me personally. It has nothing to do with what I think everybody else should think. But for me personally, the Hall of Fame should be for wrestlers. It shouldn't be for executives or announcers or kind of the peripheral characters that make a wrestling show. There's a place for them. There's a way to recognize people like that, people like me. But I don't necessarily think it should be the Hall of Fame. To me, to a certain degree, I would feel like I would be diminishing the accomplishments of some pretty great people. Or not diminishing, but diluting by being included in that group. I mean, wrestlers are unique people. Their families are unique families. They've had to endure amazing things to just get to the top and then endure 10 times more than they could have ever expected or hoped for or thought about in order to stay there. So when you have someone like Hulk Hogan, when you have someone like Ric Flair, when you have anybody that you want to name who's been in the business for 20, 25, 30, 35 years and has stayed on top and contributed so much to the genre, the amount of sheer endurance and talent that person has is amazing. And I just don't put myself in that same category.
Yeah, that's a fair answer there, but to counter what you're saying there, I mean, what you did, you know, in the business is still being felt today at WWE. Most recently, the WWE produced a series on the WWE Network called The Monday Night War. I want to get your thoughts on that, if you've seen it or not, but they pretty much kind of put you over big in the last episode about what you added and the fact that if it hadn't been for the competition between Nitro and Raw, they probably wouldn't be around today as far as what they did with the Attitude Era and all that. I don't want to get your comments about what you think of the series, and also when you came over to WWE in 2002, what was that experience like in meetings with Vince McMahon?
Okay. As far as the Monday Night War, I haven't seen it, and I will be watching it this week. I keep saying to myself, oh, I gotta order WWE Network. I've been intending to order it since it launched. It's just that I travel so much. Half the year I live in Wyoming, half the year I'm living in Arizona, and when I'm living in either place, I'm traveling 75% of the time. So for me to actually sit down and sit in front of my computer and, you know, subscribe to something, it doesn't seem like it should be so hard, but it is. But I'm going to do it this week because, you know, with the debate coming up, and the debate is about the Monday Night War, and I have heard, look, I haven't seen all of it, okay, but I've seen some of it, and I've been a part of some of it. The various narratives or DVDs, if you will, on Monday Night War. And I've read a ton of comments from people in WWE talking about their perspective on the Monday Night War. And I'm happy to hear from the final episode of the series, they recognize, you know, what WCW accomplished and how it changed the business and probably improved the fortune of WWE. I'm happy if that's happened. I haven't seen that. But the majority of things that I have heard coming out of WWE tend to be skewed, and one would expect that. I think that they're bad people for doing that. In fact, I have a ton of respect for everybody there, so it's the exact opposite of that. But nonetheless, the perspective, and it starts from the very beginning. For example, I don't want to get into this too much because that's what the debate is going to be about in Philadelphia. But for example, the way they framed the narrative back in the day, starting in 96 and 97, was that big bad billionaire, you know, Ted Turner was beating up on this poor, independent, you know, family-owned wrestling company. And he's throwing billions of dollars at it, trying to put the WWE out of business. Well, that's just bullshit. It's just, I don't know another way to say it. It's just not true. That was not the goal. It was never the goal. Ted Turner never said to me, I'm going to give you all the money you need, kid. Just go put Vince McMahon out of business. That never happened. What happened was Ted Turner, who, if you read anything about him, or if you study him at all, you know he built his entire media empire on the fact that it's smart to own your content. Don't rent content, own content. That's why he built that's why he bought the MGM Film Library, for crying out loud. That's why he bought New Line Cinema. I mean, that was his business model. So rather than renting wrestling from WWF at the time or whatever it was, Ted saw a local territory or business that was available, and being Ted Turner thought, hell, why should I rent it from this guy over here when I can own it? It's perfectly consistent with his business model, whether it be news, movie studios, the Hanna-Barbera, you know, animation studio, you name it. That was Ted's, you know, business philosophy. That is why Ted Turner got into the business, not to beat up on poor little Vince McMahon or because he had some personal grudge. And in terms of, you know, Ted's running billions of dollars and giving me all the money, the open checkbook, and, you know, AT America and all that, you know, hyperbole that I've heard and read so often, that's not true either. The fact is, when I took over WCW, it was on the verge of death. There were almost everybody in the company, other than Ted Turner, wanted to pull the plug on it because of the embarrassment that Bill Watts had just put them through because of the just horrible financial outlook for the company. It was only grossing $25 million and losing $10 million a year in the process. That's what I got handed, along with a mandate that said, make this company profitable. Well, the first thing that I did was cut costs. I mean, I shut down house shows because they were losing money. I did everything in my power, and sometimes I did things that were just over the top. Like, you know, one day I remember in particular, I made all the executives that reported to me go back to their office and count their pencils. And they all looked at me like I was stoned. So what do you mean count my pencils? I said, just go count your pencils and come back and tell me how many pencils you have. And then they all came back and wrote down a piece of paper. And they told me, I said, there, now you know what the most minimal resource you think, you know, is a part of this company, which is probably the pencils in your desk. You know exactly how many there are, and you probably know what they're worth. know, approach everything else in your business the exact same way. If you don't know what your assets are, you don't know what your liabilities are, and vice versa. So it was that process of turning the company around, demonstrating not only to Ted Turner, because he wasn't watching it, other people way below Ted were watching it, but it was a process of a year or two of my making pretty smart decisions, cutting the budget, stopping waste, stopping fraud where it existed in the company, because there was a lot of that going on within the travel department, and I put an end to all of those things. And it wasn't until they saw that I was actually operating WCW as a business and that it was possibly light at the end of the tunnel did they start increasing my budget to do some of the more obvious things that people now recognize. But I had to earn the right to do those things. They weren't just handed to me on a platter so that we could kick Vince McMahon's ass. That's the distortion. That's the false narrative. That's the image that, you know, people generally want to have of WCW, and it's not true.
Speaking of WCW, I'm pretty sure you've been asked this question before, but so listeners to the GRP here, what was your initial reaction? You know, you had spent time with a media company trying to purchase WCW and the assets of WCW, and I know that there was something in the WCW magazine at the time called a pay-per-view you guys were going to produce called The Big Bang that didn't happen. And, you know, I just want to ask you, what was your initial reaction to finding out that WWE had purchased WCW? And was there any kind of contact between the WWE and yourself about you coming over during the invasion angle?
You're covering some different time periods there. So going back to the pay-per-view that never happened, it was essentially a pay-per-view that I wanted to do December 31st, 1999, mm-hmm. because everybody was just thought that the millennium change was going to, the world was going to get turned upside down. It was the last day on Earth and all that kind of crazy stuff. And I had successfully was able to coordinate a pay-per-view event in Tempe at the football game on that night. And Gene Simmons and Kiss were going to perform in the end zone. That was the idea. That never happened. And that didn't happen for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that the employees at WCW didn't want to travel over that period of time. And it was basically a palace revolt on the production side of things. And they weren't employees of mine. They were kind of independent contractors that we used from other areas of Turner production. So it's not like I could force them to do anything. But, you know, the idea of traveling over Christmas and New Year's, especially because of the whole end of the world theme that was playing at the time, they made enough of an uproar that I was forced to abandon that pay-per-view. But that happened in 1999. As far as my dealing with Fusion Media, that happened a couple of years later. Fusion Media was the company that I used or I worked with to attempt to purchase WCW. We raised $67 million on Wall Street in order to make the purchase. We had a letter of intent. We had done our due diligence. We had, contracts in development. I mean, everything was moving forward until literally almost the last minute. I had a phone call saying, deal's done. Turner is taking the television portion of the deal off of the table. They don't want wrestling on any of their networks in any way, shape, or form. So if you want to buy the company, but just the no TV distribution. And it wasn't worth anything to us at that point. And I was devastated. Put a lot of work into it. I was looking forward to it. So naturally, I was very disappointed, but went on with my life. And it wasn't until, and WWE never had, they had never reached out to me until, maybe they did in 2001. They might have reached out to me when I was on vacation somewhere, and the timing was just horrible. It was kind of a last-minute thing. I remember Jim Ross calling me and asked me if I'd be able to fly in the following. It was on a Thursday. They wanted me to fly in on a Sunday to do something. I had too many things going on. I couldn't do it. And it was subsequent to that when Vince McMahon called me. And I don't remember what year it was, 2002 or 2003, when Vince called me, and we had a great conversation, and I ended up going to work with him.
What was your vision for WCW in 2001? Had you purchased World Championship Wrestling from Turner, what was the plan for WCW? What did you envision? Obviously, you had to erase a lot of pretty bad programming with WCW in 99 and 2000. What was your goal or what was your vision?
I think, you know, probably first and foremost, it was more of a strategy or tactics than it was a creative vision or goal. We were dealing with the obvious being that the brand itself, you know, although it was phenomenal for a couple of years and, you know, there was a lot of great positive attention to it and we achieved all those great things, it, as you pointed out, through the latter half of 98, almost all of 99, 2000, it just reeked. It was horrible. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. But it, nonetheless, it sucked. And I knew that in order for us to turn the company around as new owners, new management, the first thing that we had to do was rehab the brand, which is in many cases a lot more difficult than starting something from scratch. And there's two schools of thought. One is, yeah, but it's an established brand, and you know people will come and they know what it is, and they'll at least sample you. Probably true to some degree. But when the brand is so bad and the people that are aware of it are aware of it, not because, yeah, it's pretty decent, but are aware of it and their impression is it just sucks, then you have to recognize that. And that's when you make the decision to rehab a brand and rebuild that brand is going to take time. Lots of time, lots of money, and lots of hard work. It's not going to happen on its own. And we knew we had to rebrand and rebuild. And our strategy for doing that, quite frankly, was to take it off the air and have a relaunch. And I don't remember if it was 3 months or 6 months later, but there was going to be a period of time when we would have gone off the air so that when we came back, you had the feeling of coming back fresh with new talent, not completely new, we weren't getting rid of everybody, but with a lot of new talent, with a different feel, clearly different storylines, different tone, and a different branding within the show. That was the goal. Beyond that, I can't, you know, articulate any specific, you know, creative plans, who was going to have the title and all that kind of stuff, because, frankly, I'm not sure if I had dug into it that deep at that point, and if I did, I don't remember. I'd be making it up. But strategically, tactically, we knew we had to rebuild the brand. That was first and foremost.
Was part of your deal to buy WCW would have included the contracts? Would it have included Ric Flair and DDP and Goldberg, Booker T's contracts? Would you have also honored those contracts as well under your umbrella?
Yeah, that was part of our business model.
Okay.
That was a part of our plan.
Okay. When do you think WCW really lost its momentum? We know exactly when you lost the Monday Night War in terms of going off the air. We know when Raw finally caught up to Nitro and beat Nitro in the ratings head-to-head. But at what point do you feel like WCW really lost its momentum? I mean, we had 84-week winning streak. Everything was going really well. The NWO was clicking. The undercard was clicking. The luchadors were doing great. The cruiserweights, etc. When did you feel like, personally, that the momentum that you had was kind of falling off the tracks?
It really started in... Yeah, there wasn't one moment. It wasn't like, you know, I showed up on Monday morning and life was great and WCW was on top of the world and, you know, everything I touched turned to gold. And then on Tuesday, it all went to shit. It wasn't like that. It was kind of like Chinese water torture. You know, a lot of times you don't notice the first drip, you know, that hits you in the back of the head. You might not even notice the second one, but after a while, it starts driving you crazy. And that's kind of what it was like for me. I call it death by a thousand cuts sometimes also. In 98, started about the time that the whole AOL, Time Warner merger was starting to manifest because, and of course, I know a lot more now, you know, than I did then, obviously. I've learned a lot. I've read a lot more. I've watched it happen to other people. But again, if you put yourself in my shoes at that time, I had no real experience at all at that level of corporate play, okay? I had never been involved in a merger or an acquisition. I didn't really understand what happens politically you know, when something of that magnitude occurred. So I kind of went into it fairly open-minded because I was told, literally, by Joe Levin at a Christmas party that Ted Turner was at. I wasn't the only one there. You know, a lot of executives were there. But, you know, we were all told, not me personally, but we were told as a group. It was a small, intimate group. But we were told that, you know, by Joe Levin, you know, we wanted to be a part of, you know, Ted Turner, and we wanted Ted Turner to be a part of us because that entrepreneurial instinct that has driven the Ted Turner organization is something that we, Time Warner, desperately need. And I've always considered myself an entrepreneur. Ted's an entrepreneur. Most of the people that were really successful around Ted were entrepreneurs at heart. Ted nurtured, when I say nurture, it sounds a little fatherly. Ted appreciated and encouraged people to take risks. He knew that there were going to be failures, but as long as your scorecard was good and you succeeded more than you failed, it was okay. You know, just try and be innovative. So I naively believed what I was hearing in early 98. It wasn't until I started seeing how that thing was, how the merger or the acquisition was really going to manifest, meaning all of a sudden, even though I had gone through the budgetary process in 1997, you do your budgets a year in advance. So 1997, I submitted all my budgets to the finance committee. I got them approved for the following year, 1998. But somehow in the middle of 1998, even though I was operating within my budgets, and according to the budget that had been approved for me by the finance committee, all of a sudden I was being forced to make some pretty drastic changes to my production budget, to my marketing and promotion budget. Changes that had a very detrimental effect on a variety of the revenue streams. And it just started slowly to collapse. It didn't happen overnight. But about mid-1998, somewhere maybe towards the summer, that was in the summertime, I remember, I got called into a meeting. And you know, I've covered this before. I'm not going to do a lot of detail, but I got called into a meeting with 12 or 15 people who I'd never really seen before, all of whom really smart, talented people and executives from around the country. And I sat and listened to 10 or 12 people tell me how I was going to produce wrestling and how I was going to change the content of my show. And it occurred to me right then and there that the wheels were falling off, and I was really no longer in control of my company. I was just the person, you know, at the head of the table, but I wasn't really in control. Whereas up to that point, I had been, to a large degree. That's when I started really seeing it shift. And then I saw it shift before the audience did, because I knew what I was up against. I knew what was happening to my budgets. I knew what was happening, you know, in so many different ways. But it didn't become apparent to the audience until probably late 98, early 99. And by then, it was devastating.
Yeah, one of the things I saw as a fan back in WCW, and I want to ask you about this, January 4th, 1999, you know, it's been covered to death. But I have to say, as a viewer watching Nitro, where it kind of fell off for me is the night of the finger poke of doom angle between Hogan and Kevin Nash. And the reason why I think you guys that night kind of lost your momentum a little bit is because the entire night we had heard Tony Schiavone talking about how the WWF was going to have Mick Foley win the title, and pretty much trying to, you know, as you stated before, you know, kind of diminish that moment. And then on Nitro, we see what was supposed to be a main event between finally Hollywood NWO versus the Wolfpack, and then the finger poke happens, and I'm not getting a joke. You know, and a lot of people inside the Georgia Dome's not getting a joke. And I wanted to ask you, who came up with the idea for the finger poke of doom? And, you know, why did somebody think that would actually work?
Fans have the luxury now of, as we all do, you know, everybody has the luxury now, but looking backwards, that was it. That's exactly when it started to happen. And it may have been that way for you.
And
I'm not disagreeing with you. That was a bad decision. You know, it's not one that I remember making, quite honestly, but, you know, I've only produced about 5,000 hours of TV, so they kind of run together for me. But
it's clearly
stood out in a lot of people's minds as a very negative thing, so it must have been in many respects. But I don't think that was the moment. You know, Mick Foley likes to talk, you know, when you told everybody that was a piece of garbage and it was no big deal, and you saw people going to not tune in to WWF because you kind of, you know, crapped on his storyline, and they came and they watched, you know. Is that what did it, really? Was our lead and our position that fragile that, you know, one thing could have done it? My response is probably no. Just like one thing didn't get us to the height that we were at, that one thing took us, you know, to the other end of the equation. But it was certainly that moment on January 4th, whatever the day was, you know, was probably, it probably didn't help us. But that was one of many things.
Right, and I agree with you. I mean, personally, as a once again, as a viewer, what I saw at WCW at the time was that, I mean, the NWO made it explode. NWO, you know, took it to a whole different level, and even the WWE realizes that angle and is what caused really the Attitude Era. But as far as a viewer, when I saw the NWO angle happen, and then the Wolfpack came along, there was really no type of conclusion to that feud. And I think that's kind of where, I mean, that War Games you guys produced in 98, where you had the three teams, I think that should have been the conclusion right there between the two groups, the two factions there. You know, Kevin Nash has stated several times over the years that he didn't have anything to do with that situation there as far as the finger poke of doom. He says he wasn't even booking WCW at the time. So when did Nash actually start booking WCW?
I don't remember. That's, you know, I don't mean to be evasive. It probably would have happened if I left WCW officially in September of 99, and I was pretty well headed out the door in my own mind, probably by May of 99. So I would guess, and it's just a guess, that Kevin would have stepped in to try to help with booking sometime in the spring or summer of 99, but I could be wrong. I don't recall.
And what was the, you know, the finale going to be there between NWO Hollywood and NWO Wolfpack? Was there ever going to be just that final War Games match between the two factions and finally dissolve the NWO? Or even better, when you guys, if let's say you had bought the company, would you guys have eventually gone back to that storyline again?
Hard to say. You know, it's so hard 20 years later to try to imagine what we would have done or recall exactly what was going through our minds in any given moment or any given episode. I think, you know, the best way to answer that question is to kind of frame, you know, what the architecture was for NWO going into an event, for example, sold out, the pay-per-view. The critically acclaimed, the critically dumped on pay-per-view known as Sold Out,
right,
which was NWO's, you know, sold their exclusive pay-per-view. That idea, it was kind of I don't want to say it was a test, but it was a test. The idea was really, and as it had been from the very beginning of in the creation of the NWO, we wanted to have control of our own war. We wanted to have our own, much like Raw and SmackDown, we were doing the same thing.
Right.
We had Nitro, successful show, we had NWO, okay, successful angle. Cut to Ted Turner giving me a call, not Ted Turner, but Harvey Schiller, after hanging up with Ted Turner, saying, oh, by the way, you know, Nitro's so successful on TV, we want 2 hours in prime time on TBS. So come up with a show and call it Thunder. And he didn't say what to call it, but it was basically, I want a show, and this was Ted. This wasn't me. I didn't want the show. I had my hands full. But we knew that we had to fill another 2 hours on Thursday nights. So the idea was, let's build NWO so we can have an NWO versus WCW ongoing two brands. Let's give, you know, NWO can have one night, WCW can have one night. Much, not unlike what you see now with Raw and SmackDown. That was the original intent. So to the best of my ability, I'm guessing my intent was not to have a final NWO versus NWO or NWO versus WCW and put a, you know, a stake through its heart once and for all. It would have been to try to find ways to grow the two brands, WCW and NWO, and perhaps even, you know, Wolfpack and NWO. But I don't recall the details. I'd be making shit up.
Okay.
What is the origins of the NWO music? We've heard all kinds of things that came from an adult film. Did you produce that music? Did you have somebody write that theme? And where did it come from?
It came from a catalog of drop neo music that Turner owned. And it literally, and I don't remember who found it, to be honest with you. It may have been Craig Leathers or somebody on Craig's team. He was our director. Could have been Neil Pruitt, who was kind of involved in this type of thing. I can't tell you who it was, but they went through all of the music, the catalog of music that Turner owned, so we didn't have to pay any rights fees for it. And they found that music, and it just had the kind of vibe and kind of had the feel that fit.
It definitely did. Definitely fit. And then with the Voodoo Child music, there was all kinds of reports that you paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for the rights to that music and can only use it for a short period of time. Can you speak to that? Is that actually true?
I don't recall. I think I paid, I don't think it was 100. It may have been. I just can't remember. It may have been 100, may have been 75, but I could use it anytime, anywhere. I could use it as often during the show as I wanted to. The only limitation I had on me was that I couldn't let it run for more than a minute or a minute 30 at any one time.
Okay.
Because that's essentially would be like using the music in that, for something other than what it was intended for. So, and if you go back now and you look at what it would cost, if Vince McMahon wanted to use a popular song, even a classic rock song, by someone like Jimi Hendrix right now, and you'd be able to use it on his show on Monday night, you know, one or two times a night, on his pay-per-views, on his own videos, anywhere he wanted to use it in his universe, it cost him millions of dollars. And the fact that I got it for 75 or 100 was a freaking bargain. And to this day, people still send me, you know, emails or, you know, unless I'll get a note in the mail from somebody saying, every time I hear Blue Child, I think of Hulk Hogan and you coming down on Nitro. So there was a strong association, and it was part of the formula that worked. Certainly it wasn't the one thing that made it all work, but it was certainly a part of it.
So, okay, maybe you can answer this question for me. Right now on the WWE Network, a lot of the music that you guys had at WCW outside of the Rock House, the NWO song, is dubbed over. Voodoo Child is one of them. They replaced Voodoo Child with the NWO black and white theme for Hogan to come out to on the shows. So I guess that's a lot of royalties people have to pay in order to have that music even play on the WWE Network.
No, it would cost them, that's what I just said, it would cost them a fortune.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, WCW had the rights. I negotiated the rights with the family, the heirs of Jimi Hendrix. Did the deal directly, myself. I didn't go through an agency or, you know, outside attorney or anything. We negotiated it ourselves with the family. And yes, if Mr. McMahon wanted to continue using that, it would cost him a fortune, which is why he's not doing it. But it didn't cost us a fortune. It didn't cost us millions of dollars. It was relatively inexpensive, and particularly when you look at what we really got and the rights we had for it. It was not a lot of money.
Okay.
While we're quoting money figures, I just wondered, that Monday Night Wars series, they said a couple of times that WCW lost $15 million in 1999 and $65 million in 2000. Are those numbers accurate?
I don't know. The $15 million in 99, I would say, are kind of accurate. And when I say kind of, this is where it gets really complicated. And unless you've been in the finance department of a big corporation and understand how all of this works, then it's going to be hard to follow. But Turner had a unique system of accounting, and there's nothing fraudulent about it. I don't mean to suggest that. It was called GAAP, Generally Acceptable Principles of Accounting. So nothing too funky going on there. But for example, if you were to look at the Turner Financial Report, say 1998, you wouldn't find WCW on it. There were no line items for WCW. WCW was in a small category called Other.
Wow.
Which means other holdings of parent broadcasting that weren't broken out individually. Now, we had our own internal budgets, obviously the finances that we really operate from, but if you look at Turner's financial reports, the corporate Turner, not corporate WCW, the corporate Turner, you couldn't find the WCW line item on it. Now, what happens in probably starting in 97, but certainly in 98, and it got horrible in 1999 with regard to the mergers and the acquisitions. So you had Time Warner, then right on top of that, you had AOL. The stock bubble. Everybody should remember what was going on with stocks at the time. Turner was going through the roof. Turner stock was going through the roof. Time Warner stock was going through the roof. Once the proposed acquisition of Time Warner by AOL, Turner Time Warner by AOL, started getting headlines, it really started getting interesting. But what was really more fascinating, and I think reflective now what happened to not only to WCW, but to a lot of other divisions within Turner Broadcasting, is key executives, in order to make what they call EBITDA, which is a financial term, and earnings before interest, depreciation, taxes, and so forth, in order to reach their goals, they had to shift money around. And keep in mind, there are a lot of people that didn't want WCW on the books, a lot of executives, with the exception of Ted, who, by the way, had zero power at that time. I didn't know that. Ted probably didn't quite know that. But there were so many things happening around Ted that this kind of snuck up on him as well. So what was really happening is that in order for everybody to make their respective numbers what they wanted them to be going into the acquisition, they moved money around. Not illicitly, not fraudulently, but they just decided, okay, well, WCW's got a production budget of, I'll pick a number, $50 million for 1999. You know what we're going to do? We're going to cut that by $20 million. And just they'll figure it out. Because they could take that $20 million and put it somewhere else where that line item looked better, or that department looked better, or that division of the company looked better. So that kind of thing happens so often. And one of the other things that happened is we got losses dumped on us. So at the end of the year, and this happened even when I was closely involved with the finance side of things, is, you know, they're called charge-offs. You know, if you knew you were going to take a hit and you knew it was coming no matter what, sometimes it's better just to get it over with and lump it into a category of this is never going to happen again, and one-time kind of charge-off. And WCW got hit with a lot of that in 1999, particularly in 2000. There was a ton of that kind of accounting that was happening, not just to WCW, but to other divisions in the company as well. And the net result was that our numbers looked much worse than they already were. And they were bad. Not trying to suggest that they weren't bad. But when you asked me, was $15 million loss accurate or $65 million loss accurate, I couldn't tell you because I don't know what was lumped into that. I don't know where those losses came from. I have to really look at the accounting to be able to tell you if it was accurate or not. And I never saw it. Never laid eyes on it.
Okay. My question for you is, do you keep up with a lot of wrestling products today? I mean, we have so many. We have, obviously, WWE. You know, there's TNA, Ring of Honor. Lucha Underground, New Japan is making a big, you know, trying to make a big introduction to the United States. Do you currently watch any of the wrestling products today?
Very little. And it's not a reflection on what I think of any of it. To be honest with you, I watched a little bit. It's really more a function of I don't watch television much. You know, if it's a show that Jason and I are producing and my company's producing, you know, certainly I'll watch it. If it's a show that I find interesting because it's a new format, or I think that maybe I can find a way to, you know, to take that idea and add something to it and maybe try something else, you know, I'll watch television from that point of view. But for the most part, I watch documentaries, I watch, you know, news a lot, current events. I probably spend more time watching C-SPAN than I have watching wrestling in the last couple of years. So I just don't watch that kind of entertainment. But I occasionally, I will drop in if I hear about it, if I read about something going on, somebody that I know or a talent that I'm particularly interested is involved in. You know, I'll tune in, but I don't watch it regularly.
Okay, that's fair enough. Right now, I don't know if you know this or not, but the WWE product is pretty bad. Other than a couple of good workers they have there, Seth Rollins, etc. What would you do today in 2015 to kind of change the WWE product? I mean, I think today WWE needs a show like Nitro to challenge them to make them better. What would you do if you had, say, taken over? This was let's put it to you like this: say you had won the war. Say you had purchased the WWE. What would you have done with the WWE roster? Who would you have brought in from WCW? And would there have been a WCW network?
God, I don't know. It's just that's so hard for me to answer with any level of honesty or accuracy. I just don't know. It's so hypothetical. I couldn't tell you what I would have done. You know, as I just said a few moments ago, I don't watch enough of WWE to get a sense of what's great or not great about it. I think, you know, if I have one impression, and it's not a very valid one because, I don't watch it often enough for what I'm about to say to be anything other than a vague opinion, but there's a sameness that I've seen in the product over the last few years. And when I say sameness, I mean great talent, amazing talent in many respects. Production is second to none. No one's ever going to be able to fault WWE production in any way, shape, or form. But the characters, the stories, and I use the word tone a lot when it comes to television, because tone is not always so obvious to a viewer. It's sometimes very subtle. Sometimes it's subliminal. But the tone of what I see over the last couple of years of what I've seen has been so much the same. It's almost like there's a factory somewhere that's producing, instead of widgets, wrestlers. And yeah, there's red ones and blue ones and green ones and, you know, all different colors and some are tall, some are short, but they kind of all feel like they came out of the same press, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I think it's that lack of, and when I say diversity, I'm not talking about racial diversity so much as I am, or cultural diversity, although that's part of it, obviously. But the diversity that I most sense lacking is the diversity of the characters themselves. They all have this kind of sameness about them that I think is, if there is a problem, and I don't know that there is, they're still drawing 4 million people on cable television. WWE is still the number one, you know, show on all of cable television. I mean, there's so many things that they're doing right on a business level that it's really hard for me to suggest, you know, what I would do to turn things around. I mean, I'd cut my left arm off for 4 million viewers a week. That's what I would do. But if there's anything that maybe the viewer is sensing, is just that lack of diversity in characters and story.
Do you feel like that the WWE going more towards a PG younger crowd, you know, age 13 is their main demographic now? Do you think that's really hurting WWE in today's society, where, you know, you're in reality where you see all kinds of things going on in real life? You got a show about pregnancy and real life situations. Do you feel like for WWE today that PG rating is hurting the company in today's product?
No, the opposite. You got to keep in mind, look, the end game for television is advertising. It's that simple. It's not even eyeballs. It's not even, look, they're getting 4 million, I keep saying this over and over, and they're getting 4 million plus viewers a week just on Monday night. That is a massive number. If you look at ratings for television shows across the board, you can compare it to, you know, one of my favorite series on FX is Justified. They kicked Justified's ass. You know, they're delivering a big audience, but unless you can sell that audience to an advertiser, it really doesn't matter how big it is.
I want to ask you, do you have any, I mean, if you could pinpoint one thing, what would be your biggest regret running WCW?
I've been asked that a couple times, so it's given me an opportunity to think about that a little bit more than I have in the past. There's a couple.
Okay.
I've said before, I regret not leaving WCW on my own terms in 98 when I first sensed what was going down. I knew better. I should have followed my instincts. I didn't. I wish I would have. Whatever night it was in Norfolk, wherever the hell it was, when DX showed up on Nitro to try to get into the building, I really, really, really wish I could call a do-over on that. Because that would have been phenomenal television if I would have let them in.
Yeah.
And we would have had that confrontation. It just would have been some of the best TV in history. And I really regret not, you know, being able to think on my feet quickly enough and analyze the situation fast enough to make that choice. Because if I had 5 minutes to think about it, I would have.
Do you have any regrets in terms of Bret Hart, the way he was utilized in WCW?
No, no. No, it's, look, I still like Bret. I know Bret said some pretty shitty things about me and whatever, but it's Bret. It's a very, I don't know what it's like now, but so much of what I've read and heard coming from Bret has been kind of negative and sour and bitter. And I get thrown into that, and that's fine. It doesn't really matter to me. But, you know, I brought Bret in. I treated Bret well. I did everything that I could. You know, did I come up with the absolute best way to use Bret Hart? No. Did Bret Hart come up with the best way to use Bret Hart? No. Bret Hart was a shadow of his former self by the time he got to WCW. I think the whole, you know, Montreal, the screw job, you know, all that, you know, really hit him hard. I mean, Bret really saw himself and probably still does as some kind of Canadian superhero. And the way that went down, I think, really affected him. It probably would affect a lot of people, but or most people, but it affected him more so. And then when you combine, you know, the tragedy with Owen on top of all that, he was a broken guy. He would show up, you know, the day of television, you know, an hour before he was supposed to go on the air, looking like he slept on a park bench and didn't really have a lot of interest in anything. And this was from the very beginning, by the way. This isn't something that happened over a period of time and he didn't like the politics and he didn't like, that's just an excuse. The reality was Bret wasn't really engaged. I didn't have the magic bullet. And it just didn't work.
Well, was there any plans to eventually put Bret Hart with Hulk Hogan in the ring? Because I think that's the match that people wanted to see in WWF. It never happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, we had talked about that, and I think there's something that probably would have happened, could have happened. But a lot of it had to do with Bret, you know, Bret's attitude. A lot of it had to do with Hulk's attitude. And a lot of it just had to do with Tommy. And I'm not suggesting that either one of them said they didn't want to work with the other, any of that kind of, you know, backstage political drama, because I don't recall any of that really happening. But it's timing. And if it was something, you know, it was something that we talked about, and I'm certain, although I can't recall specific details of the conversation, but I'm certain it was something that, A, we wanted to build up to and have a good story to back up, similar to what we did with Sting and WL and Sting and Hogan. We wanted to build it over time, didn't want to just throw it up there. And it had to fit. We couldn't just all of a sudden turn everything upside down and say, okay, let's do a Bret Hart Hulk Hogan program. It had to feel somewhat organic. But unfortunately, the wheels started falling off of everything much before we could have ever gotten to any of that.
Now, I know, too, Bobby the Brain Heenan is always critical of the Goldberg situation in terms of you should have kept that streak going. The fans were still buying it. People were chanting his name. Who cares if he's 100-0, make him 101-0, 102-0, et cetera. Do you kind of regret ending the streak when you did?
No, I don't. And Bobby could have been right, or could be right. I don't know. It's easy to have perfect 2020 hindsight when you don't have to be held accountable for a decision. And it would be easy for me to say, God, if I just would have done that, then everything else would have been different. But that's not, you don't know that. You can't go back in time like that, 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, and go back to a moment or a decision and say, I'm certain that that, you know, was a mistake. And if you would have done this, better things would have happened. because you can't be held accountable for that. It's just your opinion, and everybody has one. I don't know. Was it the right time? Were people getting bothered? Were they still buying into it? Were we running out of guys for him to beat? Was it time for his character to do more? Keep in mind, the reason he had the win streak that he had was because he had no real wrestling skills. When we took him out of the NFL, put him in a wrestling school for a couple months, and had him on national television, for crying out loud. There was a limit to the type of match that he could have. He couldn't go out there and have a 25-minute match, you know, with anybody. And not without risk of hurting his character or physically hurting someone or not looking as good as we needed him to look. You can expose a lot, you know, in matches when people in them aren't ready for them. So I don't know, you know, I don't know if it was time to end it or not, to be honest with you. I'd have to go back and look at tape.
Okay, and I have this question for you here. Something I've always wanted to know. The Bash at the Beach 2000 incident involving Vince Russo and Hulk Hogan. Recently, they talked about that on the Monday Night War series. And I just wanted to know, what was your reaction when Vince Russo made the comments about Hulk Hogan? And was that a work or was that a shoot?
What Vince Russo did following, once when Bash at the Beach occurred, we had a storyline laid out. That storyline had been approved by Brad Siegel, who's the president of the network, myself, and Hulk Hogan, who had creative control. Russo was in the room when we were on the conference call with Brad. There was no misunderstanding. There was no ambiguity. It was a very clear and decisive plan that we had. And once we executed our, when I say we, meaning Hulk and I, executed our portion of the plan in the ring, the script called for Hulk Hogan and I to leave the building, cameras to follow us out, leave the building, and literally get on a plane and leave. Because storyline-wise, Hulk Hogan was pissed, and he was going to take his belt and go home. That was going to be the storyline. What Russo did is improv, because he didn't like the story the way it was laid out. He didn't like the fact that he was called into an office and put on a conference call with Brad Siegel and me and Hulk and told that he was going to do something that he didn't really want to do. So what he did was improv. And once we left, he got in the ring, and he just went off and went into business for himself. And I didn't know about it, and Hulk didn't know about it, until we landed. I mean, we literally went right from the arena to a jet that was waiting and jumped on the jet and flew home. Private jet, and we were high-fiving each other. We thought everything was great, and it wasn't until we landed and Hulk's phone started blowing up and people started telling him what had happened that we realized what Russo did. And this isn't my opinion, by the way. This has been litigated in court. It cost Turner millions of dollars in breach of contract because Hulk did have creative control. It was violated and breached as a result of what Russo did. So it's not just my opinion, and I don't know what they said on Monday Night War. I'll look at it, but I know for a fact that happened. And so does the legal department at Turner, because yeah, they had the right to check for it.
Yeah, he basically stated, I'm talking about Russo, basically stated on the Monday Night War that Hogan knew all about it. And then all of a sudden there's a lawsuit from Hogan. Like, I guess Hogan, his own words were, Hogan went home and Hogan was reading the internet. And then all of a sudden,
that's just so ridiculous. It's so preposterous. And I think, you know, I'm not going to say anything disparaging about anybody, but one only has to look at the track record of people and things that they say and their distortions and all of the things that they're pretty much documented. That they pretty much allowed themselves to be documented saying, and you just look at the body of work and decide he's telling the truth. It is what it is. That's the one thing that still pisses me off, but it's all right.
You know, in that Monday Night War series, JBL made the comment that Vince Russo took over the great company of WCW and basically bankrupted it. Do you feel like that's a fair characterization of what happened with Vince Russo in WCW?
No, I don't think it was fair. It WCW was, nobody wanted it to be there in the first place. The only person that wanted WCW to be there is Ted. That's it. There was nobody on the executive committee that wanted that company to be there. So as they were pulling the rug out from underneath Ted Turner, as a result of the Time Warner and AOL acquisition and merger, the handwriting was so on the wall. Going back to 98, like I said, I mean, the handwriting was so clear that it doesn't matter who would have been running that company or what the situation would have been, the company wouldn't be there today. They didn't want it there. They didn't want wrestling, period. They didn't want it profitable. They didn't want it unprofitable. They just didn't want it.
And what do you think about Arn Anderson's theory that Vince McMahon basically sends Vince Russo down to WCW to sabotage the company?
I don't know. I have a hard time with that one. I don't know. It's hard to say. I think if anything is possible, but I don't buy it.
Can you clear up something, too? You were talking about Hulk Hogan have creative control. How many guys in WCW really had creative control over their character and their storylines?
One.
And it was just Hulk Hogan?
It was Hulk Hogan. There were a couple others, and I don't remember who they are, that later on, after they had renegotiated a couple times, you know, their agreements had expired and they had renegotiated new terms, a couple of them would have gotten kind of meaningful consultation or reasonable consultation, but no one had creative control other than Hulk Hogan. Everything else is a distortion, blown out of proportion, and, you know, made to fit the narrative of, you know, everybody had creative control, so nobody could make the decision. It's just more horseshit.
And can you say, like on a daily basis or a weekly basis or a monthly basis, at the heyday of WCW, how much interaction did you really have with Ted Turner? Was he hands-on, hands-off? What was his approach to wrestling at that time?
I had one meeting with Ted Turner in all the years I was there. That was the meeting where it was Ted, myself, Harvey Schiller, and Scott Sassa were in the room. That was the most, you know, intimate setting I had ever been in, or meeting that I had ever been in with Ted. And that was one time. Prior to that, my only interface with Ted would have been at corporate functions, where there were anywhere from 50 to 1,000 people in the room. And it wasn't directing one-on-one, and he wasn't talking to me or about wrestling or anything of that nature. So he was not hands-on. Did not have anything to do with our tactics, our strategies, creative. He didn't have any suggestions. He didn't have any criticisms. It's as one might expect of a guy that was worth billions of dollars, that had the largest media empire on the planet at the time. He just really wasn't high on his list of things to pay attention to. Now, occasionally, I would get a phone call, and this is when Nitro was really doing well. I would get a phone call, and it would probably, more often than not, you know, Ted would be on it, but it was really Ted Turner, Scott Sassa, and Brad Siegel would be on the call, and it would be short. It would be, congratulations, great job, you know, Monday night, and rocking it, keep up the good work, take care. I mean, it was that kind of thing. So that was really the limit to my exposure to Ted.
And if given the opportunity to return to WWE in some type of a capacity, whether it be kind of like what they're doing tonight, they have the Raw reunion where they're going to have a lot of the legends come back tonight. Would you do it?
I don't know. You know, it just depends on timing. If I get a phone call today, I couldn't do it.
Right.
If I got a phone call next week, I might be able to, I might not be able to. It's not a question of would I be willing. That's because I love working there, by the way. Let's go on a record with that right off the bat. I enjoyed every second of it. I respect Vince McMahon. I have a ton of respect for everybody on his production staff. Stephanie, you know, Linda, the people that I dealt with while I was there. I do not have one potentially negative thing to say about any of them, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. That being said, you know, as a character, just the person playing a character, to go back and kind of do the same thing that I've done a million times and the audience has seen a million times, it may be the audience may get excited about it for a moment. It may be an interesting thing to watch for a night or two, but unless there's something really fun about it and new about it, meaning the story or the approach to it, then I would be reluctant, only because I just don't want to embarrass anybody or myself. I don't want to bore anybody. I don't want to come out there and try to recreate this character that, you know, became irrelevant, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. Oh, be hard. But look, it's the right situation. When I say the right situation, I'm not talking about money or anything like that. If a story or an angle came my way and I could get excited about it myself, hell yeah, in a heartbeat. But I would be reluctant to do anything that didn't really make me feel like the audience was getting a big kick out of it, because I'm just same old, same old. I just don't want to do that.
Fair enough. And my final two questions for you is going to be this. What are your thoughts on Sting finally debuting for the WWE, the only guy to hold out, never came over from the WCW? And also, what do you want your legacy to be in the world of wrestling, sports entertainment?
As far as Sting is concerned, I'm really happy for him on a personal basis. I know, and I don't, I want to be careful, I don't want to suggest that I know Steve Borden really, really well. I know him pretty well. I know he's gone through a lot over the last 15 years, 20 years, personally, professionally, and I know it's been a ride for him, and he's good human being, and an honest human being, and a sensitive one. And I think that this opportunity for Steve Sting to step out in front of that crowd at WrestleMania, which is like a crowd like no other. You know, Sting is, you know, he got to be a part of, you know, the biggest stories that we had going, and, you know, 40 or 50 or 60,000 people in the Georgia Dome and selling out arenas. So Sting has had a taste of the big time with WCW. But WCW at its biggest time is in a fraction of what WrestleMania is. So I'm very excited for Sting on a personal level to be able to step onto that platform, whether it's in the ring, performing, or whatever you're going to have him doing. It doesn't really matter that much. I think what's important is that he gets to step out onto that platform and get the recognition from the audience that I think is going to mean a lot to him, and be able to say, okay, I've done it. I've covered it all. So for that, I'm very, very happy. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the second question.
Oh, the second question was basically, what do you want your legacy to be in the world of wrestling and sports entertainment?
I don't want to say I don't think about that, because it does cross my mind once in a while, usually in an interview like this. I don't really know, to be honest with you. I guess, you know, I fight pretty hard. It's one of the reasons why I'm doing this debate with Bruce Pritchard, because I call bullshit when I hear it or see it. And there's been so much distortion over the years about Monday Night War, WCW, my role in it, Hulk Hogan and the Vince Russo nonsense. I mean, there's so much BS out there, and it tends to get under my skin when I hear it. So I know I fight for, and it's not necessarily my legacy, but I want people to really understand, first and foremost, professional wrestling is a phenomenal business. It's a phenomenal part of our pop culture. It's been the number one form of television since the beginning of television, whether it's syndication, whether it's cable, whether it's pay-per-view, now it's digital. Wrestling has always been at the forefront of any one of those mediums. And that says a lot for the business. But there's also a lot of crap that goes along with it. And I guess I'd like to be remembered as someone that took some chances, that was pretty creative, and get recognition for the things that I did try that were successful. I don't mind thinking to get the stupid shit I did that wasn't, but there was a lot of really great material there. And someone that helped make the business better. And I think I did. Others may argue that I didn't, but, you know, I feel like I brought wrestling, because a lot of the things that I did, almost single-handedly, with a great team, but the vision was mine, the risk was mine. It did a lot of things in the mid-90s that really took wrestling to a level that I'm not so sure it'll ever be again. And I'm proud of much of that. all of it, but much of it. And hopefully people will remember some of it.
You know, with Randy Savage was just announced for the WWE Hall of Fame. Of course, he worked for WCW. I just wondered your reaction of the Macho Man finally being announced. And do you have any insight of what took so long for WWE to finally honor Randy Savage? Ever know the backstory of the friction between Macho Man and Vince McMahon?
First of all, I'm not familiar with any backstory or history or any of that kind of stuff. Never heard any of it. So I can't comment on any of that. As far as how long it took or why it took so long, who knows? I mean, I don't know. I've never been a part of that decision and that decision-making process. You know, one of the things that I've always thought about, and it happens every year, you know, ever since we started doing this, is like, you know, they're going to run out of legends pretty soon. I mean, you can't, you know, induct every, you know, huge name in the history of the business over the last 20 years over a three-year period of time, because pretty soon you're going to be, you know, inducting, you know, the greatest catering service WWE's ever had. It gets to the point where you got to be a little judicious and pace yourself. So I don't know if, you know, Randy, WWE waiting until now to induct Randy was just part of that natural selection process and them pacing themselves. I don't know if there's some internal pushback. I don't know. All I know is fans are happy. From what I've read, I don't know Lynn Poffo. I talked to him once or twice in my life, but from what I've read, he's happy. So if the fans are happy and Randy's family, you know, Randy's happy, then, hell, perfect timing. I don't know what the bitch is. Everybody's happy. Let's find something to bitch about.
Was it true that Lanny Poffo worked for WCW behind the scenes? And was he ever an on-air talent at any time?
He did work for WCW. He was under contract. He was not a part of behind-the-scenes machination, to the best of my recollection. He might have showed up as an agent one time or something like that. I don't recall it. And, you know, I'm going to be careful how I say this, so I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But Randy loves Lanny. And Randy loved his family and would try to take care of them in any way, shape, or form he could. Randy was a very generous person, and Lanny was there because Randy was there. Let's just put it that way. And I'm happy that I could have made that happen for Randy and for Lanny.
And you know, when you get around to watching that Monday Night War series, there's a tall giant who has some disparaging comments for you. I think he calls you a mean little bitch. I'm talking about Paul White, the Big Show. I don't know if your history there, but he wasn't too complimentary to you on that series.
Yeah, I didn't see it, so it's hard to make a comment on something I didn't see. I find it difficult to understand why Paul would feel that way. I certainly don't recall ever doing anything to or with regard to Paul that could be considered mean. You know, Paul was young, Paul was naive, Paul was moody, Paul was insecure, believe it or not, in many respects. And I'm sure there were things that went on around Paul that for some reason he thinks that I was responsible for. But I paid him on time, paid him well, treated him with respect. Probably didn't put up with all of the shit, which maybe rubbed him the wrong way. But other than that, I don't recall ever treating Paul with anything but professional courtesy and respect, and in many cases, you know, as a friend, because he was.
You know, yeah. Let me say this real quick about that. Paul White basically stated on one of the, it was on WWE Confidential back in the day, as Steve brings this up. He said that you were paying him $165,000. That's what he said. You paid him $165,000, and he's a world champion. But yet there's other guys making $400,000, $500,000 a year, and that he said that you wanted him to sign a contract a year before his deal was up, and he wanted a raise, and you told him that he wasn't over enough to deserve one, and that he told you something about he was going to go somewhere and get over. So I think that's where that comes from.
So this is just fun for me.
Yeah.
So the general narrative is that Eric Bischoff was a pushover who just gave away money to everybody and would do anything necessary to keep his talent happy and keep his talent from going to WWE. But then, so that's the one narrative.
Uh-huh.
But now you've got a guy saying, well, he's paying me $165,000 a year, wouldn't give me a raise. Well, okay, it's probably because he had a contract, and you don't renegotiate contracts in the middle of a contract. So I could probably assume that if he came to me for a raise in the middle of a contract, I probably would have said no. I tried to say it nicer than that, but I wouldn't have been able to do it, or wouldn't have done it. And as far as, you know, what he wanted, I don't recall. I don't remember what I was paying Paul. But Paul was new, and he was fresh. And look, one of the challenges everybody has in any business is everybody wants, well, if he's making that, I want this. Everybody bases their worth on what they see other people around them making. Some cases it works. You know, if you're operating heavy equipment and you're operating a crane and I'm operating a crane, we're both working in the same gravel pit, then yeah, I guess that makes sense. But when it comes to talent, when it comes to a performer, it's a little harder. It's just a little harder, and especially if you're the talent. Because as Paul must have said, assuming everything you said was 100% accurate, Paul must have said, well, wait a minute, I'm a heavyweight champion. If this guy is a heavyweight champion, he's making 700, then I should be making 700 because I'm the heavyweight champion. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
It just doesn't. So if he said that happened, I've never known Paul to be a liar. Is he destroying it? Is he trying to make a case and get himself over? Is he just trying to come up with good content? Maybe. Or maybe it's partially true. I don't know. But like I said, I've never been mean to him. I've never been a little bitch to him. Just didn't put up with a lot of his shit.
But in fairness, he did also say that when you came over to WWE, that you showed a lot of character for the things that you had to do on television. So he was nice about it at the end. I mean, Chris Jericho said it best on the Monday Night War series. He says that maybe, this is Jericho's own words, maybe you were an asshole, but he says maybe we were all assholes because that's what WCW turned us into.
That's a context type of thing. I have to see it, and you know, I don't want to suggest what might have been going through Jericho's mind, but you know, was I an asshole at times, whatever that means? Probably. Mm-hmm. You know, was I under a ton of pressure? Was I managing, you know, a $350 million a year company with, you know, 100 pieces of talent that were all, that all needed full-time babysitters? Yeah. Was I traveling, you know, 4 out of 5 days a week, you know, jetting back and forth, you know, doing TVs? Yeah. Was I putting big deals together? Yeah. So were there times when someone could have walked by me and probably saw a look on my face and perhaps even said hello to me, and maybe I didn't hear them, or maybe I was preoccupied with something and they took that as me being an asshole? But for the most part, I think I've always treated people pretty fairly. I've always been really honest with people about stuff and chat very straight with them. Sometimes that's uncomfortable for people. And if they interpret that as being an asshole, then so be it. But, it, you know, it's a competitive business. It's a hard business. And I think we all, to Jericho's point, there are probably times when we all are less, or we have been less than the people that we really want to be under those circumstances. But generally, I don't have any qualms about the way I treated anybody. What? Quite the contrary, actually. I took care of a lot of people. He did a lot of things that, you know, nobody talks about to try to help a lot of people that needed it desperately. So I have a very clear conscience when it comes to the way I treated people.
Final question I have for you, Eric. A lot of things have been said about you, a lot of things written. I know you follow a lot of people on Twitter and social media, and you actually hear things, you read things. Lots been said about you over the years. What do you think is the biggest misconception people have about Eric Bischoff?
I guess the one that stands out to me that I hear from time to time is people talking about my massive ego. And for the life of me, you know, I try to be reflective, you know, and look at myself, you know, objectively and the way I've conducted myself in the past and acknowledge the things that were less than what they could have been or should have been. But I never had considered that I had an ego in the unhealthy sense. I was always willing. You know, the reason I ended up as a president of WCW is I was willing to do the grunt work no one else wanted to do. As an announcer, and when I got hired to come in and put pressure on Giovanni and Jim Ross, as Jim had said to me, I was just doing the grunt work. I would have taken out the plants. I would have edited the show. I would have delivered tapes. I would have put up ring. I would have done anything. And that's just my work ethic. So I get confused when people hear from, you know, reading and writing and talking about, oh, you have such a massive ego. It's just, I don't know. I don't know what they're talking about, to be honest with you. Because that's the one thing I think that's just not true. I don't have a lot of ego. I've always had a lot of pride in my work. I've always had a lot of confidence in myself. I've always had a stupid work ethic. And I've always pressed very, very hard, personally and professionally. But it's not because of ego. It's just because of the way I was brought up. I was brought up to work hard and to accomplish as much as I can. So if that's having an ego, then I guess I do have one. I just need to reevaluate it.
As we close with you, can you go ahead and plug your websites, your social media, and upcoming appearances you have?
Well, yeah, no, if people want to check me out. I don't really do Facebook too much. I keep that just to close friends and family. But you can find me on Twitter at ebischoff. And really hoping that your listeners in the Philadelphia area, or anybody that's going to be on the East Coast this weekend, have a chance to come out and check out this debate, because you're going to hear, much like you've heard here on this interview, but I'll be challenged. You know, Bruce Pritchard has his own ideas and his own perspective of what was really going on at the time. And it's different than mine in many respects. And the cool part about the show is that it's not going to be, you know, with respect to you guys, it's not going to be the host asking the questions. It's going to be the fans. And knowing Philadelphia fans the way I do, they're going to be very direct. They're going to expect honest and direct responses, and they're going to challenge what they hear. And I think that's what's going to make it such a dynamic event. I'm looking forward to participating in it, especially with Chris Jericho as a moderator, because if anybody's going to call BS, yeah, when he hears it, it's going to be Chris. I think it'll be fun. So I encourage everybody to check it out if you can.
Well, we definitely appreciate your time. I know this is something for Frank D to cross off his bucket list. He finally got a chance to talk to Eric Bischoff. So we definitely appreciate your time and your candor on this interview.
Get yourself a new bucket, brother. You need one.
If you enjoyed today's Gerwick Report podcast, we encourage you to go to gerwick.net at www.gerwick.net, your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news since 1997. You can also find all the archives of previous editions of the Gerwick Report podcast there. Additionally, check out our Facebook discussion group at facebook.com/groups/Gerwick Report. We're on Twitter at Gerwick Report. You can follow us on YouTube, our YouTube channel at Gerwick Report on YouTube. Find us on Stitcher, on Spreaker, on TuneIn, and on Blog Talk Radio. Check us out on Instagram, and we appreciate your support here at Gerwick.net and the Gerwick Report podcast. Again, check out all your wrestling news at Gerwick.net. And stay tuned for the next edition of the Gerwick Report podcast.